For all you elk hunters out there, chasing turkeys is basically the same thing. I know the reaction you just gave me, but don't knock it till you try it, and don't try it without OnX. The Hunt app will not only help you find new areas on public ground, but I use it to find out landowner info to get permission on private ground that I see birds on as well. OnX Hunt has a special offer for you. Use code CAL to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt and find more birds this spring.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
From Meat Eater's World News Headquarters in Bozeman, Montana, this is Cal's Week in Review, presented by Steel. Steel products are available only at authorized dealers. For more, go to steeldealers.com. Now, here's your host, Ryan Cal Callahan.
For the first time ever, scientists have cryopreserved and then revived an entire piece of ocean coral. You may remember cryopreservation from documentaries like Mel Gibson's Forever Young and Star Wars. Researchers are still a long way from freezing Han Solo, but I'd say this is a good start. Scientists used antifreeze and liquid nitrogen to freeze coral fragments in a glass-like state, and then thaw them and return them to seawater. They report, in a study published in the journal Nature Communications, that for 24 hours after the corals were revived, they consumed oxygen at a rate comparable to corals that had never been cryopreserved. This is important because it could give biologists an easier way to preserve biodiverse genetic material from coral reefs around the world. The current method for preserving this genetic material is to collect and freeze coral sperm. And I bet you didn't even know coral had sperm, but that's why you listen to this podcast. Anyway, learn something new every day right here. 3/4 of all stony corals reproduce sexually, meaning they're composed of males and females. When a male coral and a female coral love each other very much, you guys know the deal. And love doesn't really need to come into it because corals just broadcast their goods out there and they mingle and figure it out on their own. Females, in fact, release millions of eggs into the ocean, and males release millions of sperm. The Earth has lost about half of its coral reefs since 1950, so scientists have tried to preserve genetic material by collecting and freezing coral sperm. The problem is, coral only releases sperm a few days a year. These days are difficult to predict, and sometimes marine biologists miss the event entirely. That's why they're so jazzed about being able to preserve an entire piece of coral. This new cryopreservation method will allow them to methodically collect coral from around the world, freeze it, and have it on hand to grow new reefs in the future. Just like with animal gene banking and cloning, we shouldn't rely on this technique to save coral reefs. It's much easier, and much less expensive to conserve what we have right now rather than, punting the coral down the road and letting science and magic swoop in some unnamed date to rectify our laziness. But as one tool of many to help save coral reefs and the species that rely on them, it's still pretty cool, you know? So like, again, space travel movies, right? One step closer. Or can you imagine like the self-driving car and you just kind of like freeze yourself and wake up in the armpit of Florida when the tarpon are running, right? There are applications that I could see would be helpful. This week, we've got the Snort Report, drones, regulations, and keep your hands off our wildlife dollars. But first, I'm going to tell you about my week. And for those of you who listen to me drone on and on about the anxiety of the all-too-brief hunting season last week, I have to recap with the first official Snort Report of the season. That little dog does not tolerate the heat well, and it was hot. Despite this, she has not lost anything from last season. It is crazy to me to think that we can pick up where we left off. We joined up with my old buddy Garrett Smith, aka Dirtmyth, and a new friend, Bob. Bob has a 2-year-old female Griffon and is the type of fellow that gives you the full rundown on his dog and what to expect, exactly how you should do it. Neither of our dogs paid much attention to each other. The pointer ranged around and pointed things, and the lab stayed tight. And just for context, you got to remember this is little bird season in Montana. Grouse and partridge, not pheasant. And I'll be honest here, for the high prairie, a pointer is the better tool in the doggy tool chest. But don't tell Snort I said so. Anyway, I'd say 60 to 70% of our 4 mornings of hunting, the pointer did the bird finding and the retriever did the retrieving. Conditions were hot and dry, with the exceptions of irrigated bottomland. There just wasn't much moisture. Not even enough to make dew, which is kind of a pun. But not good conditions for dogs in general, and not good conditions for picking up scent. Despite this, our first day we located 2 groups of birds. The pointer got some great points, most of which were real live game birds. Bob, Garrett, and I shot well enough to put most of our bird opportunities in the bird bags. Snort was killing it on the retrieves and on marking where the birds went down. In those conditions, it's very hard for a dog to smell a bird on the ground, particularly when it just drops out of the sky. Despite that, she found them fairly automatically. With the heat, she wasn't like really interested in bringing those birds to hand, meaning that she would really want to drop them as she got to me, but she would hold the bird when I prompted her to do so. Holding a bird after you just did a wind sprint in 80 degrees looked miserable, so I wasn't pushing it. Unfortunately, as we crept into the third day, we had some sore cactus feet and our hottest day yet. At this point, we were fortunate enough to get permission on a hayfield that was cut, and we could drive in that hayfield. And this is where and how we encountered our best opportunity of the trip. In order to save the dogs, because it was so stinking hot, we just drove my truck until we found a covey of sharptails. And man, did we find a big covey of sharptails. We geared up, and then we kind of like worried those birds until they eventually flushed out into the big tall prairie grass. So they left the short cover, got into the tall cover, and during that, I even picked up 1 young sharptail that let us get a little too close. By picked up, I mean shot, and Snort retrieved it. It was great. Anyway, the stage was set. We were 3 days in. The dogs had worked beautifully together. We had shot great. And now we had a huge covey, biggest covey of the trip, pushed into the tall grass. For those of you who don't obla sharptail hunting, birds that you see land in thick cover are much easier to get into close shooting distance to. And a big flock that hasn't been shot at in this particular situation should be easy pickings. We communicated well. We had our location landmarked and our shooting zone set. Then the birds flushed and dogs ran. And Bob and I yelled. We yelled at the dogs. We yelled at Garrett to keep shooting. And then we yelled at Garrett to reload and shoot some more. And then we shot and yelled at more dogs. And we shot too far and nothing fell. And the birds just kept popping out of the grass. At this point, I was so disgusted that I wasn't even reloading. We just looked at each other and kind of jointly agreed that we just acted like a bunch of amateur jackasses. Or professional jackasses, maybe. You be the judge, right? And I couldn't help but think about that one for a while. And it was good to get it out of the system, I suppose. The last day, Bob and Gare headed west for home. The sky was amazing. It was dark and brooding, full of contrast, a little sniff of rain in the air, a few degrees cooler, and Snort and I struck out and found a long draw to walk. There were no cattle in it. It hadn't been hayed, It was just a big, beautiful, thick grass bottom. And we enjoyed it. And honestly, it was just kind of nice to be out there walking in just a small team. And just about the time our walk could be summed up as just a walk, old Fuzzy Butt started picking up the pace. Her sniffer sending unknown information through her muscles in the form of electric shocks. Looks like when you get, go to physical therapy and they hook up electrodes to you and your muscles dance. That's what Snort looks like when she's on birds. It was a phenomenal little walk, maybe even too easy. I'd guess like 3.5 mile loop, and we put 4 birds in the cooler and a really tired dog in the back seat. It was a heck of an end to the first trip and a heck of a general start to the season. Last thing I want to tell you in the Snort report here. Aside from the fact that the new side-by-side is an absolute delight in the field, a new obsession of mine that Weatherby will soon be severely back-ordered on, I am sure, because they are amazing. When we got home, Snort and I did work on some backyard retrieving and getting that bird to hand, and that little shit was perfect. Would hardly drop a bird when I asked. Maybe ice-cold sharptail is the Labrador's popsicle on a hot day. Moving on to the whitetail desk. Should hunters be allowed to use drones to recover game? According to the state of Michigan, the answer is no. The state is in the midst of a lawsuit brought by an entrepreneur from Ohio named Mike Yoder. Yoder started a company last year called Drone Deer Recovery that uses high-tech drones equipped with thermal imaging to find white-tailed deer that have been shot and lost by hunters. Yoder has over 30 drone pilots in 15 states that hunters can call in to help them recover their deer. The drones fly about 400 feet in the air so they don't disturb other deer or wildlife, and once they find a heat signature, they confirm the deer's location using a camera. Yoder told the outlet AgWeb that if temperatures are between 30 and 40 degrees Fahrenheit, he can pick up a heat signature up to 48 hours after a deer has died. Yoder says most of his clients are archery hunters, and that makes sense. Studies on lost game vary widely, but low-end estimates are that archery hunters lose 10% of the animals they shoot. Other studies put that number above 50%. Whatever the real number is, Yoder says his service is an all-around positive. Hunters can recover the animal they killed without spending hours tromping through the woods, and since the hunters don't own the drones themselves, they don't have the opportunity to do any surreptitious scouting, meaning they're not going to abuse the technology. Yoder operates in states from Idaho to New York, but most of his drone pilots are throughout the Midwest, but he doesn't have any pilots in Michigan. That's because Michigan's drone statute prohibits hunters from using drones to, quote, take game. In another statute, the law defines take to include collecting animals, which is why Michigan is currently barring Yoder and his drone pilots from their borders. In a complaint filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation, Yoder argues that this restriction violates his First Amendment rights. When Yoder locates a deer, he sends the location of that deer to the hunter so the hunter can collect it. This location data is the speech Yoder says Michigan is restricting. According to the complaint, the state's drone statute, quote, singles out a particular type of speech and prohibits its creation and dissemination if it will be used to collect the game. This, he says, constitutes a First Amendment violation. He wants the court to declare that the statute is unconstitutional and impose an injunction restraining the Michigan DNR from enforcing it in this way, which, of course, makes me just wonder how many archery hunters are using this service if Yoder has the cash to take that type of an argument to court. The DNR has so far declined to comment, citing the pending litigation, but you can imagine why they'd be hesitant to give anyone permission to operate a drone for any kind of hunting activity. I doubt Yoder and his drone pilots are helping their clients scout for deer while they look for a deer carcass, but I suppose it is possible. And if the DNR starts allowing hunters to use drones to find dead deer, what's to stop them from also using those drones for other hunting purposes? I'm not saying it's a great argument, but I can see where they're coming from. Whether you live in Michigan or not, you'll probably have to wrestle with this issue. Drone technology has gotten better and less expensive. Average Joe Yoders can now afford technology that would have been way out of reach just a decade ago. How and when Average Joe can use that drone is a question worth asking, and I'm curious to see how the Michigan courts will respond. if you want to know what I think, why would you put a beautiful, super fun to watch blood trail following dog out of work to fly a frickin' drone? That's what I think. Technology is not always the solution. You're a hunter. Dogs and game retrieval go together very well. For those of you who say, yeah, but a dog running a blood trail could mess up more hunting, I say this, take a better shot.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater.
For all you elk hunters out there, chasing turkeys is basically the same thing. I know the reaction you just gave me, but don't knock it till you try it, and don't try it without OnX. The Hunt app will not only help you find new areas on public ground, but I use it to find out landowner info to get permission on private ground that I see birds on as well. OnX Hunt has a special offer for you. Use code CAL to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt and find more birds this spring.
Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear, what I like to do, on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, which gives you great smoke at 180 degrees, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. This is my way of bowl staying. If I was going to cook roast one way, that's how I like to do it, sear roast. Utilize the smoke boost setting to intensify that smoky flavor. Direct flame cooking creates searing, crisping, and browning. Food is going to look as good as it tastes. This grill gets hot in 15 minutes. Cleanup is easy. Cook confidently with intuitive digital controls at the grill, and enjoy the sleek, easy-to-use surface. You can also add a heavy-duty rotisserie or rust-resistant griddle insert to up your game. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.
Moving on to the Wildlife Funding Desk. Federal auditors have accused Maine state government of diverting $2.6 million that was supposed to be used to fund wildlife habitat projects, hunter education programs, and outdoor recreation. Hunting licenses and gear purchases generate billions of dollars every year for federal and state governments. This money is supposed to be used for wildlife and outdoor recreators, but sometimes public officials can't keep their greasy little paws off that pile of cash. That appears to be what happened in Maine. Between 2017 and 2019, state officials siphoned off money that was supposed to be used for hunting and fishing and used it to pay for the state's pension fund. $1.2 million, for example, was supposed to be used for wildlife assessment and management. $817,000 was supposed to be used for fisheries, and another $108,000 was supposed to be used for land acquisition. Auditors say the state also diverted about $550,000 of hunting and fishing license sales, which is typically like the operational budget of a game and fish agency, to build a private shooting range for law enforcement personnel. These grants came from the federal government, which is how U.S. auditors got involved. They say the state used 30% of the money that was intended for the grant's payroll expenditures, so the money used to pay biologists, wardens, and other personnel, and used it to shore up the state pension fund. Aye, 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 aye. State officials claim they did nothing wrong and that this is common practice in other states. What other states? Please tell the federal auditors. Now, here are some examples, but don't think that this is common. It is not right. It is not good. And we don't want it to become common. Anyway, in Ohio, for example, the same auditors found that the state used $1.4 million of federal fishing, hunting, and wildlife grant funds to pay down its unfunded state pension debt. You might argue that by paying into the state pension fund, this money is going to benefit the state employees who would be doing the conservation work anyway. But those are the only people who would benefit. Habitat restoration, hunter education, and fisheries management benefits everyone in the state, not just public employees. Hunters and anglers are happy to pay the federal excise taxes to help keep our wildlife healthy and our environment clean, but if that money is instead being used to make up for a state's poor financial planning, I'd say we got a problem. Speaking of sweaty-palmed public officials, the Pennsylvania Senate passed a bill last week that would transfer money from the game fund to an agricultural initiative. The Senate passed HB 1300, that's 1300, on a 29-18 vote. Buried in the giant spending bill is a line that takes $150 million from the state game fund and transfers it to the Clean Streams Fund. Everyone is for clean water, and the Clean Streams Fund was created to help farmers reduce sediment in waterways that could harm marine life. That sounds good, but this bill could have unintended consequences. The Pennsylvania chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is concerned because this would set a dangerous precedent. The PA Game Commission functions entirely on money from the game fund. They don't get any general fund or tax dollars. Quote, if future legislators follow suit and conduct further raids on the fund, it will result in immense damage to the commission's ability to carry out its mission. PA hunters are also concerned because diverting money from the commission could make the state ineligible to receive Pittman-Robertson funds. This all gets a little complicated, but I'll try to simplify. Federal code prohibits states from diverting money generated from hunting license sales away from the state wildlife agency. The money being diverted from the Clean Streams Fund didn't come directly from license sales. And listen, as I'm saying this, I hope the state of Washington is paying attention. This is something that just like burns in my brain every time we talk about the governor and the state game commission in that state. Like, they are not going to function without these federal funds, and they're spitting in the eye of the program that feeds them. I digress. Federal code prohibits states from diverting money generated from hunting license sales from the state wildlife agency. The money being diverted from the Clean Streams Fund didn't come directly from license sales, but some of it is coming from oil and gas leases on state game lands purchased by license sales. This also isn't allowed under Pittman-Robertson. So, hunters and anglers in Pennsylvania are worried the state could lose out on the tens of millions of dollars it receives from Pittman-Robertson every year. And keep in mind that Pittman-Robertson excise tax dollars is hunter-paid and shooter-paid tax revenue from the purchase of firearms and ammunition. It's also worth noting that, according to the Pennsylvania Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, this amendment was proposed and passed quickly before anyone could be made aware and offer a response. Wonder why that is. The good news is, this bill still needs to pass the House to become official. The House can make any necessary amendments to make sure wildlife funding continues, and we help farmers control runoff and protect streams. Check out the Pennsylvania BHA's website for a call to action, or visit themeateater.com/cal. Moving on to the wetland desk. Protecting streams and wetlands on the state level is more important now than ever. The Biden administration just released a new rule to comply with a recent Supreme Court decision, and conservation professionals are extremely concerned. You'll remember back in episode 214 when we covered a SCOTUS ruling that reduced federal wetland protections under the Clean Water Act. Now, a wetland area can only receive federal protections if it has a continuous surface connection with a larger navigable body of water. This contradicted earlier interpretations that allowed protections for wetlands that had a significant nexus to navigable waters, even if the wetland didn't connect on the surface. Now the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers have issued a new rule to comply with the court's decision. According to Trout Unlimited, the rules removes federal protections for millions of acres of wetlands and raises questions about coverage for millions of miles of tributary streams previously covered by the Clean Water Act. Chris Wood, president and CEO of Trout Unlimited, said the rule will make our rivers and streams less fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. One of the primary functions of the Clean Water Act is to require companies and individuals to secure permits for filling and dredging work that will impact rivers, lakes, streams, and other bodies of water. Before handing out these permits, environmental experts visit the site to make sure the work being done won't impact water quality. If the Clean Water Act applies to fewer of these water sources, filling and dredging can occur more often without any kind of environmental review. It's worth noting that state agencies also have permitting requirements, so some states will continue to review filling and dredging projects carefully, but some states' policy is written to mirror federal policy. So, the Supreme Court decision and the new Clean Water Rule will apply to those states. This is an extremely complex issue, and the ping pong ball gets tossed back and forth on the Clean Water Act from administration to administration. So I'm painting with a broad brush here. I'm not saying your favorite duck hunting spot will be a gravel pit by the time duck season rolls around, but it's always extremely concerning whenever we weaken federal protections for wildlife habitat. When organizations like Trout Unlimited, TRCP, DU, Delta Waterfowl sound the alarm, hunters and anglers should sit up and pay attention. Now, none of this really affects the individual, right? So, intermittent wetlands are incredibly valuable to wildlife. They also create like very healthy soil. So they are something that gets envious eyes from farmers, okay? But there's a ton of programs out there in the Farm Bill. Many, many states have great easements that will pay you to subscribe to certain farming practices that you can go in there, you can do some hay cutting, you can plant during certain times cash crops, but you just can't permanently tile that beautiful little intermittent wetland that produces ducks, deer, birds, bees, all the stuff that you like to pay attention to while you're out there riding on the tractor. You just can't drain that thing, right? Seems like a good middle ground there. Anyway, moving on to the mushroom desk. Quick public service announcement here. Mycologists, which is a fancy word for mushroom experts, are warning about a bunch of foraging books being sold on Amazon that appear to be written by ChatGPT, which I suppose is like the new lazy man's way of busting out a book. Since eating the wrong mushroom can be deadly, they worry that amateur foragers could be at a serious risk if they take advice from these books. A few titles are The Supreme Mushrooms Books Field Guide of the Southwest and Wild Mushroom Cookbook, From Forest to Gourmet Plate, a complete guide to wild mushroom cookery. Experts say these books contain serious flaws, one of which is a recommendation to identify mushrooms by smelling and tasting them. You can see where this may go seriously wrong. Never taste a mushroom unless you know for certain that it won't kill you. And for great advice on all things wild foods that you know was written by a real human, check out all the great offerings on themeateater.com, which is a shameless plug, but we have people who know their stuff, like Jenna Roselle, for instance, okay? That lady tells you to eat something, you can eat it. Don't just go buy something on Amazon. Research the author. It's an extra step. It's no longer a one-click process. You got to think through it, okay? PSA. Don't go dying on me. I need you. Moving on to the public land desk. I have good news and bad news here at the public land desk. The good news is that we saw several stories this week of federal and state governments doing their darndest to increase public access to thousands of acres of great hunting and fishing property. In Idaho, the Bureau of Land Management opened a new backcountry conservation area called Bennett Hills. Bennett Hills is a 120,000-acre parcel of rolling grasslands in southwest Idaho. It's home to upland game bird species and serves as winter habitat for elk and mule deer. Backcountry conservation areas are a relatively new type of public land. The BLM launched the program in 2017 to conserve backcountry areas that contain priority habitats for, quote, recreationally important fish and wildlife species, meaning game animals that drive the massive hunting and fishing economy in places like Southwest Idaho. Designating land as a backcountry conservation area, or BCA, doesn't ban other uses such as mining. However, according to Brian Brooks of the Idaho Wildlife Federation, it does make it more difficult for activities like mining to be approved. He told Boise State Public Radio that developers would be met with opposition from the BLM, as well as hunters and anglers who recognize the value of keeping these backcountry areas intact. Quote, it would be a very significant battle that developers may not be willing to take on. Bennett Hills is just the third BCA the BLM has established, but so far it's the largest. Hopefully it's the third of many more to come. Hunters may be getting more opportunities in South Dakota. Pheasants Forever is partnering with South Dakota Tourism, Onyx Hunt, and other organizations to launch a program they hope will open 10,000 new acres per year to public access. It's called PATH, which stands for Public Access to Habitat. The program will pay landowners a base rate of $25 per acre for new, high-quality, undisturbed habitat that's open for hunting. Pheasants Forever says that for every $250,000 raised, they'll be able to open 10,000 acres. South Dakota is already the pheasant capital of the world, and programs like this aim to keep it that way. God, I mean, just pay attention, other states. My goodness, South Dakota just kicks ass. No other way to say it. Moving on to the bad news. Several of you wrote in to tell me about a proposal that would build a bridge through prime waterfowl habitat in Decatur, Alabama. The Swan Creek Waterfowl Management Area is located in northern Alabama, and I've heard from several residents that it's one of the best waterfowl hunting areas in a state that doesn't have much waterfowl hunting to begin with, that's open to the public anyway. The city of Decatur is located just south of Swan Creek, and they're considering a proposal that would build a bridge straight through the middle of that area. Now, for those of you who have ever stood in a marsh and swung a shotgun on a bird, a bridge in the backdrop full of cars is not what you want to see. They say, as in the city of Decatur, the bridge is necessary to relieve traffic congestion, but waterfowl hunters say it would also decimate habitat and eliminate waterfowl hunting on Swan Creek. The construction company has proposed 6 routes for the bridge, all of which impact Swan Creek in some way, but some are better than others. One of the routes cuts through a smaller portion of the WMA, and future generations of hunters might not be as heavily impacted. But construction is still projected to take 8 to 10 years, and you can bet that all those excavators, dump trucks, and human activity are going to take a toll no matter where the bridge is eventually built. Not to mention, a lot of the folks that I know that work on construction sites probably will take a toll on waterfowl numbers too. If you live in Alabama or southern Tennessee, and especially if you live in Decatur, now's the time to get involved. The mayor of Decatur is named Tab Bowling. He should definitely know how his constituents feel about this project. I'd also contact members of the city council. I've seen news reports that say several of them are on the fence, and I think a few thoughtful and respectful notes from their voters might make all the difference. We'll post links to all that contact info at themeateater.com/cal. Get a hold of Delta Waterfowl, Ducks Unlimited, and Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Audubon Society. All of those folks should be able to weigh in heavily on the imposition of a bridge through prime wetlands. And lastly, thank you so much to everybody who wrote in on that subject. I'm reaching out to a few folks as well. Try to add a little heat to the fire there. Thank you so much for listening. That's all I got for you this week. Man, lots happening. It's fall. We're going to keep it coming. It's going to be a struggle. Keep your ears on, your wits about you, head on a swivel, all that good stuff. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for writing in. I want to hear from you. So write in to ASKCAL. That's AskCal@themeateater.com. And let me know what's going on in your neck of the woods. On top of that, don't get stranded someplace you got to, you know, cut your way out of. Go to www.steeldealers.com and find a local knowledgeable steel dealer near you. Yeah, you can get your clean, quiet electric chainsaw, but you can also get a set of like 30-inch steel loppers or just a nice set of handheld pruning shears. That's going to aid you in busting down deer for quick and easy removal, home butchery projects, as well as waterfowl and upland birds. Trust me, I use them all the time. Just last night, I was using my steel pruning shears to knock the wings off of sharp-tailed grouse and then their little tiny fuzzy feet, too. Snort got a real kick out of that, I promise you. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.
Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools. It's pre-seasoned with food safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. This griddle heats evenly edge to edge, reaching all the way up to 500 degrees. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.